Simon for News on the White, and we're here at the Regeneration Conference, which is being hosted by the Isle of Wight Council, and we're with...
My name is Walter Menteith. I teach part-time at the School of Architecture in Portsmouth and practice and live in London for the rest of the week, so I'm there 2 days a week. And we've had a master's programme running.
At Portsmouth University.
Students there have been looking and researching into the Isle of Wight, and we specifically started looking at three towns, which was Shanklin, Newport and Ryde. And they have been doing this for a year. They started off by looking at the towns overall, the economic background, uncovering lots of research facts about them, looking at the general health, well-being, economic distributions, etc., and the spatial character of the towns, because that's actually what their specialism is, and how you synthesize those problems from all the information that you can foregather into coherent architectural and physical resolutions, because talk has to end in action, and action ends up in physical solutions. And what was particularly interesting, of course, is being an international school of architecture, we had people, two, who came from the Isle of Wight. About half of the students came from the UK, and about another half, perhaps less than, are international. And when we came over to the Isle of Wight, we asked them what they thought. And these are people...
On the first visit.
And we asked, as part of the analysis, to say, you know, this is the starting point. What do you think of it? None of them would have come on holiday for the Isle of Wight.
Goodness.
They found the offering was nothing to do with their culture. So that was one of the interesting first findings. So
I mean, considering how many people do choose the island.
Exactly. So one of the challenges, of course, and also what the Isle of Wight's got to be able to do for the future, is bring people from abroad.
Yeah.
You know, if this is going to be a successful economy, which has got is so dependent on tourism, and actually, you know, is an ideal place for a developing tourist economy, then what it's got to be able to do is bring people forward, not just from the English regional hinterland, but from a wider field. So that was an interesting finding particularly. So starting from that point of view, they were challenged to improve the offer, to consider the offer and how it might be addressed, and how this might inform the physical space.
And I mean, that's interesting too. You've got to satisfy the residents who are here all year round, but also having that
as an academic program,
a commercial side as well,
yeah,
of making
absolutely.
it something that can and also, self-sustain financially.
Yeah. And also, of course, it had to be a part of the academic program. So yes, very important, because people tend to think of architects as being airy-fairy, but actually, for anything to have reality in the long term, it has to deliver value. And the deliverance of that value, simply from an architectural point of view, is often different from politicians because it's within their political cycle, whereas architects are taught to think in terms of, you know, this building, the structure that will be here for 50, 75 or 100 years. So we're planning on that time scale. And of course, planning today on a place like the Isle of Wight, it's extremely important to think about sustainability and resilience, because here is an island hugely vulnerable to climate change rises in sea level, to fluvial flooding, and
fluvial flooding is river flooding.
And so this is an island which...
With increased rainfall, and
it's not necessarily increased volume overall in the year of rainfall, but it's
concentrated
rainfall and how it then impacts. And of course, temperature rises. So all those things need to be embedded into thinking today. And in planning, a lot of those considerations are still well down the line. Consistently, this happens with resilience, for example. We are not planning yet for resilience, but here am I talking today in one of the hottest years on record in human history, as recorded, and we're still not planning for the fact that this is leading to glacial melt, to the temperature of the sea rising, so they're expanding, and we haven't built this into any of these plans. So they're asked to look at those considerations too and integrate this thinking into something that can deliver solutions and improvements in quality of life.
Do you know how the first approach happened? Because, I mean, to get your master's students involved at all is I think, admirably forward-looking. So how did it come about, the process of Portsmouth being involved with this at all?
My contacts in the architectural environment are quite extensive, and I understood that the programme was developing on the Isle of Wight. Contact was made from the Isle of Wight Development Department to look for support in terms of the research, because we're living in a period of austerity. Local authorities are stripped of fundings, mm-hmm. and this fundamental research and foresight research, if you like, looking forward, needs to be done at some point to inform the more practical steps that need to follow.
And that's interesting, because often when funding is cut, we live in a pretty short-term society already.
Exactly.
But with funding cut, you find that the short-termism becomes even more short-term. So to have
is a huge fallacy, because if we only think short-term, we won't survive. We won't survive as a species. I mean, we have to look after our food chain. You know, you've got to think next year. You've got to think a few years ahead. What are you going to plant? Mm. And so, yes, it is very encouraging. And particularly, it's worth noting that this should be happening more, this linkage between academia and planning in architecture could be done so much better and so much more often, particularly in an area of when there's stress, because these things do need to be considered and brought forward.
So you said five sites.
Three sites. So there's Shanklin, Newport,
Shanklin
and Ryde.
Spa, really quite... Yeah, it sounds very glamorous.
Well, exactly. And one of the things, of course, that the students came through was the sense of identity of places. And one thing that they felt Shanklin had become is very tired. And for a resort that is very tired, it either needs to change its identity or disappear.
Right.
And so they thought that through various incremental changes that could be flexible and done by the community there, it could change it and transform its identity quite successfully above the cliff level. And then the challenge below the cliff level is really how you address the beach frontage, which of course is a threat from rising sea levels and storm surge. Already it's very close to the road. The traffic arrangements there are dreadful. So they thought about removing that and basically having underground parking at one end under a new development, and then allowing a new dune defence to run the length of the frontage,
right,
and putting in spa activities, mm, and making Shanklin an active life and health centre, mm, for the island, mm, because it's something that the island's very good at, is this notion of the active holiday, the healthy holiday, which would bring forward out-of-season economy. So, you know, they were looking towards bringing a winter economy to Shanklin, so it wasn't just a seasonal and summer economy. And I think that was a very successful idea. The notion of having a spa climbing up that cliff against the lift, so that people were coming from all over Europe to bathe, looking out over the bay and the setting sun, is just knockout. And, you know, it's got legs.
Mm.
So that was a very worthwhile little piece of examination, because it brings people to the island, to the town. And there's a lot of elderly people there, and so some of these spa resorts are quite good for health as well. And so you can see that that sort of aspect, along with the cycling they were talking about, the canoeing, the boating, recreational sporting activities, the active sport activities, as a supplement just to the beachfront, were ways of strengthening the town.
What was the way of bringing together, because there's this event at Shanklin is kind of split between the lower section. How could you make that more integrated?
The simple notion there was that what was quite interesting is the cliff is quite fragile. However,
so eventually the whole town's going to be down on the...
It has got some resilience, so it's not quite as bad as that, but it can be shored up. In engineering terms, what they sort of showed is, look, here's a cliff, but actually, if you look at the cliff, that's a huge surface area. Can the town use that surface area productively? So if it's an active sort of health centre, what you could do is you could have cliff walks,
right,
you know, built onto the cliff, so that you provide more ways for people to descend from the top to the bottom and climb up, but also something that was a really fun experience. And there are a lot of these cliffside walks all over the world now. They're not impossible to do. The rock formation would allow you to do it. And so that was a really nice idea.
I mean, there's a few paths down, but you're talking about having a big network.
There's two. And so you could transverse, you could come up, so it's more of a network. Then that particular student then thought, well, actually, if I can have some glam camping on the cliff.
Well, so the idea of pinning into the cliff and sleeping
in a hammock.
Like
sleeping in a hammock. Right. But you take that to a point where it's sort of like, you can stay in a felt tent in the Welsh uplands. So why can't you stay in a sort of glam hammock on the cliffs of Shanklin? Exactly. There you go. And you know, these are ideas which have legs, because where do ideas commercially start from? They start from a creative synthesis like that. So these are good.
And that's the wonderful thing about academia, is the space to think and imagine.
Absolutely.
Right, I mean, we could get into the idea of way that academia is being taken towards being functional. But that idea of actually thinking and imagining and considering is incredibly important for society.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because that's where innovation comes from. And if you don't have the space and the time to think, and you don't have the sort of necessary resources to fuel that thinking, you can't take these ideas forward. So, and I think, hopefully, that's a contribution to Shanklin, even if it just stirs up in people the thought that things can be far better. And it just requires us to think that they can be far better, and to look at the examples of where it has been done better, and we can aim higher than that. And I think there's a very low expectation there at the moment.
Is part of your brief the introduction of those ideas into the current public? Because there has been pushback in different areas of people feeling, well, I'm quite happy the way I'm living at the moment, so why would I want this change happening? Whereas, as you said, if these changes don't occur, perhaps the idea is the extinguishing of the town.
Yes, it is very much part of our brief. So it's very much part of our brief to try and raise the aspiration and raise the quality standard.
But also to communicate it in a staged way that people don't feel overcome by it.
Yeah, it's not quite so sort of constructed as that. It's more just a desire to contribute the notions of quality and opportunity and imagination and vision. And partly that is what architecture does in the spatial and public realm environment, and should do. And hopefully that is what it does contribute. But ultimately it's all about public discourse. And really what we would contribute to the public discourse through this mechanism is to say that if these issues aren't addressed for the future, there isn't prosperity ahead. There's a decline. Because you have to be able to draw people forward, because that is the foundation of the economy. So it is about making sure that the idea of how improved office can be made is brought forward. And when it comes to sheer physical survival, those properties on the beachfront are hugely vulnerable to storm surge and climate change-induced rises in sea level if defence isn't put along the frontage, and if that defence isn't put along the frontage in a way which is the money is spent so it improves the frontage, but it diminishes the frontage, then that spells the end to their economy, because people will simply go to better places.
Right. Without the seafront, then what is Shanklin?
Exactly. And if nothing's done to the seafront, the bottom of Shanklin goes, so the top of Shanklin is diminished.
Right.
And if you do it the other way and you do an excellent seafront, you bring more people to Shanklin. Mm-hmm. So the important economic step is not necessarily just the cost of what you're doing, it's what it's delivering over the long term, the next 100 years, in which the stuff will be there.
So I'm slightly concerned my battery is indicating. That's
all right.
So let's move on from Shanklin to the other areas.
To Newport.
Okay.
Well, at Newport we were invited to look at the area of the quays and the whole issue of the beautiful core of the old town and how it then connects to the quays and the opportunities for investment and development in the quays. And going away with that brief and exploring it and researching it, one of the huge problems, of course, is the climate change we talked about, the potential flooding from the Medina, and then also the whole connectivity across that area, because the A3020, the Medina Way,
the quotes motorway
is what I think of as a motorway, totally severs two parts of the town. The town is bifurcated. And not only that, this road that sits within a town is a road within a town which has no pavement, has no street planting, no trees beside it. You can't cross it except going under it and about one crossing to the north of the Medina or west of the Medina. And it's a nightmare, absolute nightmare. So you're forced through an underpass like a rat and, you know, you, whatever. So we just simply say, think of this road as a street. Don't turn your backs on it. Build to it. There are roads in London which have more traffic on it, and they are street frontages which have pavements, and they have trees. And once you start to think about that road as being a street, the opportunity for actually repairing and consolidating the whole of Newport becomes much easier to conceive of. And once you do that and you can think about the topography in Newport, what you're talking about is just basically walking over what was once a railway viaduct.
Mm.
Well, that topography is nothing comparable to the cities of Bath, Edinburgh, and places like that, where they challenging topographies of a far greater scale with much greater severity of incline are just walked over the whole time. So the idea of being able to walk over this road, under this road, much more easily enables you to join the two parts of the town together. On top of that, we think that taking pressure off the road is probably a good idea too, and there are many sites earmarked for development to the northwest of Newport, around by the prison. Getting to those, if by car, means that everybody then ploughs through Newport, through this dreadful motorway that exists at the moment. But at the same time, one has to protect Newport Quays from flood, from rising sea levels. So either one is going to have to build walls all along the Medina on its beautiful southern stretch where there's wonderful waterside landscape, and there are historic quays with ancient stones that have been there from the medieval period. You're going to have to put concrete on those and raise them up. Or you can put a tidal surge barrage further up the Medina and combine that with a bridging link, so that you could take transport across the north of the town.
Mm.
This would take pressure off the centre of Newport.
Because people go to the east of the west of Medina or vice versa, they wouldn't need to go through Newport.
And they wouldn't need to shake the chain bridge.
Yeah. There's been a lot of discussion, I'm sure, in your research you've come across the idea of that there's been considered before a bridge there, but I hadn't heard it about it
being
about
combined with the barrage.
Well,
what we've been looking at and we think is particularly valuable and important to consider is that money is going to have to be spent on flood defences, but if you combine infrastructure so it does more than one thing at a time,
why not get the value?
You get better value, and it makes it effectively more economic to do. But also, one has to do that flood defence at some point, or no one's going to invest in the quays in Newport because they're going to get flooded.
So where would that... Have you got a particular site?
Well, the site that we earmarked was just south of the turbine factory.
Okay.
Because we think there's an appropriate link across, which
then
takes you to
the...
The
place for that already, for the roads, is it?
There's very little, and there's very little additional infrastructure needed for a road crossing there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually seemed inappropriate. But
do you say that's
the solution
above the turbine? Just slightly south
of it. Because if you go above the turbine, they've got commercial portaging.
Yeah.
So they take their blades out.
Yeah, right.
So the size of their ships is very much bigger, whereas if you have a lifting barrage, a bit like the Cardiff Bay one, all the yachts and everything can operate down into the quays at the bottom.
Right.
So what one does in a situation like this is you write the design brief for what the technical requirements are, which services all the needs, as an engineering design brief, and then look at what the design solution to that would be.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two components that then unlock a method by which the new port can be repaired, can grow and expand into the future.
And you think the key area, I mean, there has been looking at the redevelopment of that, of it being seen as an area that's underused.
The potential in there is huge,
you think?
The potential in there is absolutely huge. And to be honest, Newport is such a wonderful town. It's wonderful except for the A3020. Uh-huh. It could be such a charmingly delightful town. Mm-hmm. But the way that that road has been cut through the town has informed all its subsequent development. So you get the whole string of sheds marching through the centre of what is a beautiful county town. It's one of the choicest core county towns in England. So why can't that be repaired, restored in a contemporary way so that holistically it's much more of a traditional shape and form and more compact so people can walk around in it more?
Is there a chance of doing this now? I'm sure you're aware that the redevelopment or there's money going to be spent on that road and the roundabout system around there.
Yes, and there's the new southern bypass. There's the new southern bypass going in as well. I don't know the latest on what's going to be spent on that actual road, but I certainly think what should be done is people should start to think about it as a street, to look at the option to put pavements on it, to think of ways to cross it and make sure that one can build buildings up to it so that it becomes a street and it feels like a street when you go down it rather than a road through a wasteland with sheds on the other side. Because that's what it's like, isn't it?
Excellent, thank you.
That's all right.
Number three.
The other town we've been looking at is, of course, Ryde. And most people's impression of arrival on the Isle of Wight, if they come to Ryde, they arrive there and they see a dump of infrastructure slapped onto the beach with sort of, you know, Eastern European Stalin-esque sort of ice rink on a sort of concrete bunker destroying the beautiful beach. And a tardy old sort of railway line that certainly these students, who are all these young people, thought was a joke. None of them liked
it. They didn't see the beauty of it.
They didn't see the beauty of it. They didn't find it attractive. They sort of thought it's the thing that should go in some old geezer's back garden for him to sort of whisk around and play on. You know, like they used to have those miniature railways.
Sure.
And so, simply put, they thought, well, you know, it's also got a dumpy marina that you can't use except about a couple of hours a day because the water never gets in. So put the marina on a pontoon marina harboured at the end, so that it's at the end of the pier.
Okay.
So you could have a pontoon harbour there, and that would be a deep water marina, open all the time. It could be well sheltered because of its position in the island.
So that would be, as you're standing on the dry end of the pier, looking towards it, be on the west of there, would it?
They were proposing originally on the west, and then they moved it to the east. I'm not quite sure why, and it has something to do with the way they were looking at the White Link boat coming in, and also the hovercraft. But if we start at the end of the pier, yes. Mm-hmm. So marina goes up there, and they think that's a place for fabulously high-quality, high-end outlets because of the views, the sunlight as the sea sets, etc., mm-hmm. etc.
Yeah, it's stunning.
It's stunning. So then what you do also is sod this idea of the train line. Get a tram. Go modern. Be European. You know, something which has got a decent braking system. And because it's got a decent braking system and variable speeds, you can have shared surfaces all the way down the pier. And you could open up the pier with a surface so it is accessible both on the west side and the east. And then you could drop off the whole side of both of those piers. Lots of sort of pop-up, meanwhile, activities. These could be boats, you know, like just like houseboats. These would be moored bars. There could be restaurant chains. There could be, you know, clothes shops, which were in themselves sort of temporary, meanwhile, activities clipped onto the side of this working pier with a shared surface, tram going down the middle, and a little bit of zest to life in Ryde. So you're welcome to Ryde. It's really generous and it's fun. Go down the pier and at the end of the pier, adjust the infrastructure. And very simply, take the hover terminal from the east side of the pier to the west side of the pier, more sheltered there. The skirt area they designed was sufficient for the four hover craft, absolutely fine. Under the skirt, as it rises up, They put an underground dike so there's a parking depot concealed, no surface parking apparent. And next to that space, at the bottom of Union Street, effectively, a new town square. And that town square can be shaped by some low-rise commercials. So you access the pier onto this, and the tram connects directly with the Hoverport, with the cars, and with a new bus station is what they designed in this location. So it tidies up and clarifies that whole bit. It gets rid of the tunnel and the rail track, which severs access to the beach. And then the next aspect of their work was the restoration of Ryde Beach, so that Ryde as a town can once again connect with a beautiful beach.
So that would be because the Hoverport's moved to the other side.
Yes.
That would become a beach where the ice rink at the moment
where the
would be
ice rink
to be a beach.
And where everything else is at the moment.
The stretch of beach there would just be huge, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
All the way down to Hapley.
So you would arrive at Ryde and there's a beach. And now you might think, well, that's a bit pie in the sky. Well, actually, Ryde has to protect itself against rising sea levels like anywhere else. So their proposal was to scrunch up all those shockingly bad bits on the front and use that rubble to create the core of a dike which would run parallel with the frontage, all along the frontage, and that the sand, which has been extending outwards on the beach there, is brought inland and up over that dike. So you just have a dune landscape stretching from the town right out to the sea. And if you want to put some commercial activities, you put them on the land side of the dike, underneath the dike and under the landscape, very discreetly, very elegantly, and you have a tourist destination that you would die for. And how's this paid for? Well, the dike has to go along, it has to connect beyond Canoe Lake. So perhaps Canoe Lake is something where we actually needed a water system because of the fluvial flooding from Brookmead, the valley there. And so that area is an area where there isn't the opportunity, if you have a system there, to build housing above it. Residential get value from that to help to pay for the frontage. And if you address the fluvial flooding issues up the valley, you also can extend the town organically rather than in dispersed suburbs that are only accessible by a car. You can extend the town organically within those areas, and that can also return value to pay for this. Mm. So that was the idea with Ryde.
And we start building tomorrow?
It would be absolutely delightful. But one of the things is that people are now so process-led, they're not led by the quality of the output. And I think what we're trying to communicate here is that actually it should be the other way around. That in a way one needs to be conscious
have
of
the vision.
And have the vision of what the civic society wants as a physical form and go for that rather than determine exactly what the process is. Not that one ignores the process, but you have to have a vision behind a process. And a process without a vision is nothing.
With the communication of this, I keep coming back to it's the academic side, it sounds wonderful. Politicians react to what the public think.
Yeah.
I don't know how council officers think. I'm not sure. I haven't figured that out.
I mean,
it's not important. It has to be communicated to the public so they understand virtual reality, perhaps, so they can walk around what you're describing.
Absolutely.
And seeing what a massive change that would be to the town.
Well, I mean, one of the issues here is that this has been done as an academic exercise. So the resource restrictions are according to the students available and the time that they've got and what we can devote in our teaching time, and of course what we also deliver pro bono, which in our case, teaching on this, it's a labour of love. So beyond that, it is very difficult, but it's very important because the position we are in academically enables us to see what is being done elsewhere in the world. We explore, we examine, we research those things, and we're also in touch with other fields that are informing the architecture. So what we can do is we can communicate across the possibilities in the real world that are available to people so that the choice is not constricted. Because some people constrict choice by thinking it's not possible to do. But if you can show that this is possible to do, you open up the choice and you open up the conversation and you open up the discourse. And we very much hope that that's what our work will be achieving. Mm. Because that in itself can lead to a higher quality output.
Mm. What are the advantages of trams over trains? Is where the tram has more freedom. So it wouldn't be a railed tram; it would be a wheeled tram.
Yeah,
wheel tram.
There's a massive variety of different transport systems you can get. So you can get guided buses now. So we weren't quite sure whether it was best as a guide, or the students weren't quite sure whether it was best as a guided bus system or a train or tram system. And then trams themselves, you've got about three or four different types. And essentially, it's sort of the key things which impact are their beds and the vibration that they create, the weight of the vehicle, the length of the vehicle, hence its turning circle, and the inclines it can go on, the speeds and the variability. But Siemens, for example, do massive different number of types. You can even get, just bounce this idea for you, you can even get very big incline trams now. So these are trams that can go up very steep.
Right.
You sit in a pod, a bit like, if you can imagine the London Eye, mm-hmm. you have the pod which rotates right. all the way around the London Eye. Mm-hmm. You put that in a cradle right. next to a tram, and it can go up a steep hill, right. down a steep hill, and you're still sitting level. Mm. So that would be a great way to go from Portsmouth to Gosport, wouldn't it? Over the top of any aircraft carrier on a variable
right.
incline. But these are technologies that are now available.
Yeah.
So the principle was that you'd have quite a tight curvature, so it'd be quite a small carriage.
Yeah.
Could be multiple carriages.
And this tram is just for within ride, is it?
No. It's basically
it's for the
same
whole of the island.
Same. It could be
the island line replacement.
It's the island line replacement, mm-hmm. but it's also because there's more railing stock, more opportunity to do it, so you wouldn't be using unique bespoke railing stock. You can take it to other places that hasn't been to before, or even take it back as a shared surface route, for example, to Newport, follow the old railway line along the A302, one that makes the A3020 again a shared surface with a tram on it, take it up to Cowes.
Mm-hmm.
No reason why not.
Okay. This has all been brilliant. This, yeah.
Yeah.
I think
it's a lot of research they've done,
yeah.
and it's very valuable research, which is why thank you for the opportunity to record this, and I hope you can use the material.
Well, it seems so interesting. The presentation that happened there, it felt like more people should be able to hear it, so it has been great to be able to sit down with you.